Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast. Boy, we have got a great show here set up for you, and this is one that's been in the works for a while, and we've only got one guest right now, but we're hoping to have two of us join us. I'm not sure how this is going to work out entirely. Yes, we're going to have people from two of our continents on here today, but we're going to be discussing a very important book. It's one called How God Became Jesus, a response to Bart Ehrman's How Jesus Became God. Now, let me tell you about the other guests that I'm going to have coming on later on. One of them is going to be Micah Bird. And Micah Bird is a lecturer in theology at Ridley Melbourne, origin of Ridley Melbourne College of Mission and Ministry in Melbourne, Australia. He is the author of Jesus and the Origins of a Gentile Mission, The Saving Righteousness of God, Studies on Power, Justification, and a New Perspective, Evangelical Theology, Bourgeois Babes, Bossy Wives, and Bobby Haircuts, A Moderate Case for Gender Equality in Ministry, and he's the editor of the Apostle Paul Four Views. He is also a co-blogger of the New Testament blog Evangelion. Dr. Chris Tierney will be joining us later on. He's a lecturer in New Testament Studies at St. Mellitus College and visiting lecturer in theology at King's College London. He is the author of Paul's Divine Christology and the editor of Beyond Old and New Perspectives on Paul. He also runs the biblical studies blog Christendom. And my current guest is Dr. Charles Heer, who, if you're remembering correctly, was here last week. And he joined the Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando staff in 1994, where he's a professor of New Testament. He teaches on Hebrews, Revelation, and New Testament Greek, and he received his PhD from Cambridge University. And he has significant research interest in the Johannine Corpus, New Testament books associated with the Apostle John, and he has researched and written extensively on several issues related to the early church fathers, particularly early Christian views of the end times, the canon of the New Testament, and the tradition of New Testament manuscripts. His most recent publications include Who Chose the Gospels, Probing the Great Gospel Conspiracy, and The Early Texts of the New Testament, edited with RTS professor Michael J. Kruger, both of which we discussed last week. Now, we're going to try and get the other guests, Dr. Tiering and Dr. Bird, on here later on whenever they're ready. The time zone's making it difficult for Dr. Bird in Australia, and Dr. Tiering is actually at a wedding in Germany right now. Not his own, though, but he's going to be taking some time in a side room later on to join us. For now, we've got Dr. Heer here with us. So, Dr. Heer, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome back to the show. Can you remind my audience real briefly a little bit about your story here?
Okay, well, I was born in Nebraska, raised in Nebraska, and attended church from my youth, and then went to university at the University of Nebraska, was involved with campus groups there, went to seminary at Westminster Seminary in California, then did a PhD at the University of Cambridge, as you mentioned, taught at Northwestern College in Iowa. And since 1994, I've been at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando. That's a quick rundown, and I'm open for any other questions.
Great. Now, we're here to talk about this book, How God Became Jesus. And you were saying last week that this is certainly an important book. Why does this book matter?
Well, this book matters because it's an attempt to respond to and set the record straight from responding to Bart Ehrman's latest book, How Jesus Became God. So most of your listeners, I'm sure, will know a little bit about Bart Ehrman's background, reputation, and his accomplishments, his many books that have sought to problematize and argue against some of the main teachings of Christianity and the scriptures upon which Christianity rests. So this last book of his is a book on Christology. I think I just saw someplace where he has said this is probably the most important book that he's written because it has to do with Jesus Christ himself and obviously the basis for faith for all Christendom. So this is an important book that he's written, and we think it's an important response book, offering a different interpretation of the evidence. As you know, Bart Ehrman is a historian, and he puts forth his arguments ostensibly on the basis of historical evidence, and comes through with a number of arguments, well-reasoned arguments usually, and so his work is very popular. He's an outstanding communicator, and has many followers all over the world. His books have been used, I think, very much, very eagerly by non-believers, atheists, and even Muslims. I've heard many times about Muslims using Bart Ehrman's books in their attacks against Christianity. So we think this is an important book to look at the historical evidence and the biblical evidence for why Christians have always worshipped Jesus as divine and considered him to be, along with the Father and the Holy Spirit, part of the one God, the Trinity in the one God in three persons.
Now, we should keep in mind with Bart Ehrman also that, in fact, he did something that, as far as I know, no other writer had ever done. That was when he wrote Misquoting Jesus. He got a book on textual criticism, something most Christians would never touch, sadly, to go to the bestseller list and stay there. I mean, that tells us something about the impact that he has, doesn't it?
Yes, it certainly does. You have to hand it to him in many ways for being, well, brave enough to take on a subject like that and put it in a readable form. He really has raised awareness about a lot of issues that have to do with Christianity. And in some ways, you know, I think in the long run, after all the dust settles, we'll see that probably a lot of good has come out even of his challenges to Christianity, just as often happens, not through his own intention, but in God's good providence. A lot of attention has been focused, for instance, upon the text of the New Testament. It has certainly, Bart's work has certainly caused a lot of doubt and questioning, but on the other hand, it's also forced a lot of people back to look at the evidence and has ended, I think, in strengthening the faith of many and really helping other scholars to get a hearing when we're talking about textual criticism and matters related to the canon of the New Testament and so forth.
This book is an excellent read. It's one that I think the layman could appreciate, and you'll find when you read it, it is filled with humor. Excellent humor. I'd like to read a section on page 8 and see what you think of this. Not everything Ehrman says about the origins of belief in Jesus' divinity is wrong. Some things are quite true. Some things we'd agree with but say differently. Some things we'd suggest need better nuance. And other things we contend are just plain out of sync with the evidence. While Ehrman offers a creative and accessible account of the origins of Jesus' divinity and Christian belief, at the end of the day, we think that his overall case is about as convincing as reports of the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, sitting in a Chick-fil-A restaurant, wearing a Texans-style cowboy hat while reading Donald Trump's memoir, which is to say, not convincing at all. But you'll have to read the rest of the book to find out why.
That's right. That's classic Michael Bird humor right there.
Yeah, and he has denied, though, that he's the one responsible for the bottle of hand sanitizer that comes with the book when you order it, better. At least when you get from Zondervan that says, wash your hands of bad history.
Yeah, he's full of a lot of jokes. Some of the other authors had to, you might say, tamp down some of the less restrained jokes, but we'll leave that for some other time to discuss. But yes, Mike has a great sense of humor, and I think that does come off in many places in the book, not just in Mike's sections, but we all wanted the book to be readable, obviously, and not be simply an academic tome, one that is backed by solid research, but one that's very readable to a wide audience.
Yes, and I do want to stress to listeners of the show, please don't think that you can just listen to this podcast alone and get the full worth of everything in this book. By all means, listen to what my guests are saying today, but this is a book you simply must get for yourself. You need to have it on your shelves and be ready. Learn the information that's in there. And, of course, I mean, we'd also say we wouldn't have any trouble with you reading Ehrman's side as well. A good Christian should be informed in reading both sides, because as I've said elsewhere, I'm pretty sure most of our internet atheist crowd and others like that are not going to be reading both sides.
Yeah, that's right. And you certainly can learn a lot from reading any of Bart's books. Many times, Bart Ehrman's bark is worse than his bite. That is, he's got a penchant for headlines and for stating things in provocative ways, but when you read the fine print, sometimes it's not as startling as the headlines are. So you can often learn a lot from what Professor Ehrman says. This particular book does have a number of his own theories about Christology that you won't necessarily find, our standard views. For instance, the notion that that Paul, in Ehrman's opinion, Paul believed that Jesus was a pre-existent angel who became incarnate and then later was exalted to a fuller divine status at his resurrection. So that's not a very common view at all. So you'll get those things, but you'll also get some good and interesting historical backgrounds.
Now there's something you all refer to in there. You abbreviate the EHCC, which is the Early Highest Christology Club. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, right. And that would be, mostly that's the section that Mike Bird did, but Early High Christology Club is a somewhat tongue-in-cheek way of referring to a number of scholars, Martin Hengel, Richard Bauckham, Larry Hurtado, and maybe others. Those scholars who have done significant work on early Christology and early historical, not just biblical evidence, but surrounding the Bible, and have concluded that contrary to the sort of traditional critical approach that has said that Christology evolved slowly from low to high, the early Christians taking a low view of Christ as a mere man, and then eventually going higher and higher to exalt him to divinity. This group of scholars has concluded that, no, from very, very early on, Christians regarded Jesus as divine in some way. And they may tease that out a little bit differently. But so that's the dubbing of Early High Christology Club refers to those who've come to that conclusion that Christians were worshiping Jesus and regarding him as divine from an extremely early time. And we would all fit into that category, defined that way, all the authors of this book.
Now, there are two other offers, by the way, for those interested who couldn't join us today. And one is Simon Gavrikov. The other is Craig Evans, who we actually had on March 1st, so that's fine. But, now, in your situation, you're the one who wrote about pretty much the early church fathers afterwards and how they saw Jesus and the Star of Heresies. And you actually started on a rather odd note by saying that while Ehrman accuses the early church of excluding those who were unorthodox, you yourself experienced the opposite of being excluded because you were too orthodox.
Yes, that's right. So I tell a little story. I won't just go through it. I'll let your listeners read it if they're interested. But the point was to observe that it's not just conservative or orthodox Christians who could be said to be exclusivists, have an exclusivist strain in their theology and practice. The story I tell is about being excluded from a liberal church, a mainline church, and you know, conservatives get the reputation of being exclusivists and non-accepting and so forth. But most of the time, liberals can be just as exclusive or more so than conservative Christians, and that was just a story that illustrated that.
But of course, we do know that in the early church that there were constantly heresy hunters going around seeking who they may devour, as it were, right?
Yeah, that's what they would have you believe, isn't it? I think Professor Ehrman plays into this popular idea of early Christian theologians in the Orthodox tradition, what we might call traditional Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, being kind of on the hunt, on the lookout for any slight deviation from standard teaching, you know, ready to strike at any point and knock everything down. So this is, you know, one thing I point up at the beginning. You know, reading Professor Ehrman's book, others as well, but this one in particular, there are often lessons that he seems to want to teach the reader. And one of those lessons that you'll pick up is that Christians, at least Orthodox Christians, Christians who care for theology and getting it right, those Christians are not people to be imitated. They're not people you want to be like. There's a strong, strong sort of ad hominem argument runs through a lot of what he says. And that's one of the things, that to portray these people like Irenaeus or Hippolytus or Tertullian as heresy hunters in that way. But it's largely a distortion. Certainly there were these theologians were concerned to protect their parishioners from heresy, but it's too easy to read back into their lives some notion that they were able to crush their opponents in some way. These early theologians had no political power. They had influence, obviously, in their own congregations, and people who read their work would be influenced, but they didn't have power to oppress or persecute. And it also, that sort of portrayal of them as kind of fire-breathing heresy hunters also ignores the fact that what we know about the heretics, so-called, would show us that they were at least every bit as intolerant most of the time as the heresy hunters. So it's a kind of a caricature, but it gives you an indication of the sort of underlying tone of a lot of Professor Ehrman's work. This kind of, you may be going to this later on, but stop me if you are. But this tendency culminates in his ultimate charge towards the end of his book, that Christians persecuted Jews because of Christians' understanding of Jesus as divine. So Jews could be portrayed then as those who killed their own God and could be charged with deicide, and therefore that would justify any kind of intolerant or oppressive actions towards Jews.
Well, I do hope we can go there further eventually. It all depends on how things are going to work out with Dr. Turing and Dr. Bird. But for now, we are going to take a quick break because I got more questions for Dr. Hill here. I'll be back after this break. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast discussing how God became Jesus.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
And we're back right now. I've got Dr. Charles here with me. We're talking about how God became Jesus, and largely about his chapters on the early church and Christianity. Now, we're talking about the heresy hunters. And I think part of Ehrman's strategy could be dealing with the whole cultural mindset we have today that the early church was seen as intolerant and that history, as we know, is written by the winners. And so there you can easily just paint a picture of Orthodoxy as the winners, so they rewrote history, and where they're intolerant, so they're definitely bad guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I think that, as we said, that's kind of a running theme throughout a lot of his work, and certainly is the case with this book as well. So the last a couple of chapters in his book do take us beyond the New Testament world into the early church, and that is one of the themes. Another one of his themes, you might say, is what he calls these ironies, or what he calls a hard and fast irony, and that is that widely held views among Christians, certain views that were once widely held or even considered orthodox, later became unorthodox or heretical, and so you in effect have Christianity turning on itself and declaring to be heretical beliefs that Christians held earlier. I think that's something that certainly something Dr. Ehrman wants to emphasize, and he does it with several examples. I argue in the response book that most of these examples are not very good examples, but certainly we have to recognize that there is a development in Christian theology. There always has been, as older ways of stating things are maybe found to be not perfect, and improvements are made, and so forth. But it's really not very often that you have something that is considered to be orthodox later determined to be heretical. And in particular, the three of the main examples he cites, I go into and argue with. The first one, and it's kind of his Exhibit A, you might say, for him the most important one is that, in his view, the views of the earliest Christians about Jesus, what they believed about Jesus, later came to be regarded as heresy. And what he says they believed was that Jesus was adopted to be the Son of God, adopted to be divine, when he was, in fact, just a man. That was that's supposed to be the earliest Christian belief, based on the belief that he had risen from the dead. So Erwin actually comes back further than a lot of scholars do, and in fact, back further than he used to do himself, to say that Christianity did adopt a view of Jesus as divine from a very early time, from not long after the resurrection. Of course, Erwin doesn't believe Jesus really did rise from the dead, but he acknowledges that some of his early followers believed he had risen from the dead. From that point, he says they exalted him to divine status in some way, and that was an exaltation to divine status on the part of God adopting Jesus to be his son. That, he says again, was the first Christian belief, but later that became regarded as heretical. It's a view called adoptionism, that Jesus, a mere man, was adopted by God to be divine, and Christians later condemned it. Well, that irony, I would say, is false on both ends. That is, you have a really hard time showing that it was the earliest Christology, the earliest faith of the earliest Christians. I don't believe you can show that, and we can go into that question. And then on the other end, the Christians or those who called themselves Christians in the second and third centuries who had this view we call adoptionism, it doesn't look like Erwin has rightly described those views. There were people called Ebionites who are said to have had this view, and so the charge is that later Christians chastised the Ebionites who actually believed what the original Christians believed. But it turns out the Ebionites, it doesn't look like they ever believed Jesus was divine in any sense. They believed he was a Messiah figure, a prophetic figure, a Jewish figure throughout, but he was not divine. So that's kind of Exhibit A in his museum of ironies of the Christian faith.
Now, there are some Ebionites, though, some people who say the Ebionites trace themselves back to James. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you can't actually, you can't disprove that the second century Ebionites might have done that, but I think you can disprove or challenge strongly the idea that they had a legitimate reason for doing that. So scholars might look at the Epistle of James and not find a great deal of Christology there. That's just the way it is. We don't find as much Christology in James as we do in 1 John or in the Gospel of John and the Gospels. And so James is looked at as very Jewish. The Ebionites were a Jewish group that didn't believe Jesus was divine. And so scholars will make that connection. But I really don't think that there's a lot that is in any way trustworthy for that. There were Gnostic groups that also traced their lineage back to James, and Gnostic groups who, or Docetic groups who couldn't believe that Jesus was human. So they believed he was only some kind of divine figure. So just because there were claims or similarities in one sense, it doesn't make a genealogy.
Now, you've said that you don't think the you can establish that Ehrman's view was the earliest view of the church, the earliest Christology. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the Orthodox view was the earliest view?
Right. Well, that's a great question. It goes to the heart of the book, and the heart of the argument, both in Ehrman's book and really in ours. And I think that Dr. Tilling would probably want to weigh in on this, as his chapters dealt with this a little more directly. But I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
Ehrman, as a historian, wants to try to find the earliest Christian traditions that he can, and of course those are actually found in our New Testament books. But like most scholars, he would say that the earliest information about Jesus is not really the Gospels, or at least the earliest writings that we have are not the Gospels, but the letters of Paul. So you can go to the letters of Paul, it's thought, and get an earlier Christology than what we find in the Gospels, strangely enough. But most scholars would agree with that in general. So you look at Paul, and it turns out Paul does have a very exalted view of Jesus, a very high Christology. He believed Jesus was preexistent. There's no question about that. But there are things in Paul's letter that seem to predate Paul. Scholars have long looked at a number of passages. One well-known one is Philippians 2, 6-11, often thought to have been a pre-Pauline hymn or a semi-creedal kind of a statement. There are places like this and others where Paul seems to be quoting or alluding to or paraphrasing earlier statements. So there you get an idea, possibly, of an even earlier Christology. That's Ehrman's method, is to go and find these earliest bits of pre-Pauline tradition and build from there. Okay, that sounds okay. Sounds pretty unobjectionable, probably, from a historian's point of view. But we have in these pre-Pauline snippets in Paul, what you could characterize in different ways. Ehrman finds in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-5, where there's a confession about Jesus being dying and being buried and then rising and then appearing to Cephas and then to others and finally to himself. There's in that confession, there's no mention of Jesus being preexisting as God or being divine. It's only a confession about his death and resurrection. And you have another place in Romans 1 at the very beginning, Romans 1:3, where it talks about, or Paul talks about, Jesus has descended from David according to the flesh and declared Son of God or shown Son of God by his resurrection. Well, there it seems that he's again only said to be Son of God because of his resurrection, no preexistence. Well, those are thought to be then encapsulate the earliest Christology. But wait a minute, you have to read a couple more chapters later in Ehrman's book, and you find out that there are some other pre-Pauline bits in Paul's letters, and they give what Ehrman calls an incarnation Christology, not just an exaltation Christology, where he's exalted to godhood. He starts out as God and becomes incarnate. For instance, 1 Corinthians 8:6 is one of those. And the Philippians 2 passage that I mentioned is one of those, where Philippians, God, Jesus exists in the form of God and does not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself and became one of us and became obedient even unto death on the cross. And therefore God has highly exalted him and given him the name above every name. You know, so there you have Jesus already God, and he becomes man. Well, in Ehrman's historiography, there is a chronological grid to this. How do we know which of those traditions is earliest, the exaltation Christology or the incarnation Christology? Well, Ehrman seems to take it for granted that it is the exaltation Christology that came first, that Jesus was only exalted to be God after his resurrection, and that the incarnation Christology must have come later. But he doesn't tell us how he can know that. He can only know that if he presupposes that. There's nothing that dates one of those pre-Pauline confessions earlier than the other. You could just as well argue that it's the incarnation Christology that is first. And in fact, I would argue that they're probably co-equally old. That is, in any confession or creed, even the ones that Christians use today, you never say everything that you believe. It's always only a summary of what you believe. And so when Paul wants to emphasize that Jesus is descended from David according to the flesh, you know, in fulfillment of prophecy, he starts there with a confession. When he wants to emphasize the truth of the resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15, that's what the whole chapter is about, the belief in the resurrection. He starts with that aspect of what Christians believe. Jesus Christ died, he was buried, he was raised. He doesn't back up to the very beginning. He doesn't need to there. So I would argue that all of these sort of creedal statements that might be pre-Pauline are already just abbreviations of a larger theology. And in fact, the one place, they mentioned Philippians 2, where we have that, an incarnation theology, we have both, really. We have Jesus in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself, and therefore God highly exalted him. So you have there a pre-Pauline statement that integrates both a what we might call an incarnation and an exaltation Christology. I think that's the way it was from the very beginning. It was an integrated Christology in which Jesus is acknowledged to be both divine and human. You know, we find this throughout the New Testament, in John's Gospel and in John's letters, in the book of Hebrews. We find it all throughout the New Testament. Different authors talk about it in different ways, but they all seem to agree that Jesus is both divine and human, and that's as far back as we can go.
Okay, well, right now we are trying to get Dr. Chris Turing on the air. Now, he is messaging me. We're trying to work out those technical difficulties, but for now, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at cyiworldwide.com.
And we're back, and my guest is Dr. Charles here, and we're trying right now to get Dr. Chris Turing here. He's by his phone. Where he needs to be is just making the connection right now. That's being really difficult. So we're trying here to do this. Now, So pretty much what you've been saying is that there never really was this period in church history where there was this hand-wringing going on, saying, oh my gosh, Jesus, is he divine? Is he not? Is he deity? Is he not?
Right.
It was pretty much the church was speaking with one voice, weren't they?
Yes, and that's another thing that Ehrman does in the final chapters when he's talking about the early church. He coins a term, he calls it ortho-paradoxes. And the reason he calls them ortho-paradoxes and not just paradoxes is that, in his view, these are paradoxes that the Orthodox had to come up with in order to sort out these conflicting ideas that were handed them by the New Testament authors. And they knew they had to come up with them also to fend off heretics who might want to go in one direction or another. So this notion of paradox, Professor Ehrman paints it as a conundrum, a big problem that the early church had, and this was a sort of a last resort. He talks about them, the Orthodox, settling for the paradox of the Trinity. Well, of course, there are a lot of problems with that. One problem is that it doesn't, when you read the church fathers, they don't seem to be settling for anything that is kind of a second choice or a disappointment, an embarrassment. They all seem, you might say, to glory in this paradox. As we say that the author of John's Gospel did, when he says that the Word became flesh, dwelt among us, and we have beheld his glory, and glory as of the only begotten of the Father. This was a glorious thing for them, that they had to confess, and they confessed joyfully that this one was both divine and human, not in a way that they could necessarily fully comprehend, but both facts are firmly and joyfully proclaimed in the New Testament, and not. I find this also a big problem for Ehrman's method, for his view, is that the notion of Jesus as God and the notion of Jesus as man were not disparate notions that the Orthodox had to deal with from coming from various sources, but we find them integrated in the New Testament books themselves, within the same author, and that's what I was getting at before, but we see it throughout the New Testament, that the idea of Jesus as God and Jesus as man is integrated in a book like the Gospel of John, or 1 John, or Hebrews, and those books like those in particular, where there's actually a lot of reflection upon both sides, you might say, of Christology, his Christ's divinity and his humanity. So, again, just rather than being an embarrassment that early Orthodox felt they were saddled with, they saw it as one of the glories of the faith that they proclaimed, and these so-called irreconcilable ideas had been they'd been reconciled to these ideas from the very beginning.
And let's talk a little bit also about what you had said earlier about how Ehrman thinks that if we hadn't had gone down this route, Jews wouldn't have been charged with deicide, and I'm sure he would probably even say that we wouldn't have the anti-Semitism that we had in the early church, supposedly, or the later church even, going on. What do you think about that?
Well, I have to say that was one of the most disappointing parts of Professor Ehrman's book. Again, this part of his larger ad hominem argument against Christians that's supposed to have been through Christianity that some Christians have done bad things. And the reason why he's able to talk about the mistreatment of Jews in a book on Christology is, in his mind, because the Jews were charged with having killed their God, this idea of deicide, and therefore that would justify mistreatment of them. Well, you know, there are several things wrong with that picture as well, I think. The only person, the only source that Ehrman comes up with that explicitly nails the Jews, you might say, or criticizes the Jews for killing their God is a person named Melito of Sardis. He lived in the 2nd century, and we have it in a sermon of his in which Melito is a very rhetorically gifted preacher, and he plays on contrasts and ironies, and one of the great ironies that he plays upon is the irony that the Jews, the people of God, turned against their own God. And he does say that the Jews essentially put God, put their Creator to death. How ironic and so forth. Well, that's true. The Melito does do that. But Melito, again, was living in the 2nd century. He had no political clout. He didn't use this as a rallying cry to persecute Jews. It wasn't until, you know, the 4th century that Christians came into any kind of favored relationship with the state. And then, so Ehrman jumps to the 4th century and finds places where Christians now in that favored position could take a different relationship to Judaism and felt that they had the upper hand. And there are times when synagogues might be burned, and Jews might have second-class citizenry in the Christianized empire. And again, this is laid at the feet of the idea that Jesus is God. Well, there again, you'd have to pause and say, is it really because Jesus thought that Christians thought Jesus was God that all this mistreatment occurred? Can't you just say that this is a sad and tragic set of circumstances because human beings are human beings, and even Christians are not fully sanctified, and their temptations to power there as well in the church. In other words, I would argue that it didn't have much to do at all with the idea of deicide. So one of the things that I go to in making that point is, we can think of at least one religion that had a prophet that was not killed by anybody, by Jews or anybody, and that prophet never claimed to be divine and is not considered divine, but that has not guaranteed that all the representatives of that religion have always treated Jews kindly. Well, quite the opposite. And if we want to go down that kind of a road, we should point out that atheism has also spawned its share of oppressive regimes. There's just no comparison when you look at the mass murder, the mass slaughter that communism has perpetrated in just the past 150 years. So it's not a very good argument. As I said, I was disappointed that Ehrman put so much stress on this in a book on the early views of Jesus Christ.
Okay, sorry about all the technical difficulties. We're still trying to get Dr. Turing on the air here. And so what we've been doing here is discussing the early church and their views of Jesus and such. And now, what about, what would you say to someone who say, for instance, that this all came up, say, at the Council of Nicaea, for instance?
Yes. What exactly is the question? I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
Well, some people might even go so far as say that this was introduced at the Council of Nicaea, but from what I remember about Nicaea, that it was, in fact, Arians' views that were seen as the very distinct difference there, and this would, in fact, indicate that Arius' views were incredibly new, rather than something that the church was really debating.
Yeah, so you can talk a lot about Nicaea and Arianism. I make the point in the book that a number of the early alternatives to Orthodox Christology and Orthodox view of the Trinity, a lot of the early alternatives simply had no long-term chance of success in Christianity, and that was because basically they were so at odds with large portions of the New Testament. And it took the church maybe a while to sort all this out and to get this straight. But a number of things like modalism, the view that there is only one God, and this God manifests himself in three different modes, not three different persons or distinct persons, but three different modes. He's, at one time he's Father, at one time he's Son, another time he's Spirit. This is an idea that took hold in around the beginning of the 3rd century. Well, that view, you could see why it may have been attractive to some at that time, for a time, particularly of people just coming out of paganism, but it had no real long-term chance of success if the church was going to base its belief on the New Testament. The same thing with docetic views about that Jesus was a heavenly being who only seemed to be human, who maybe possessed a human being for a temporary period of time or something like that. It's not really until we get to the Arian controversy that we have an attempt that sounded more biblical, that sounded like it dealt with the New Testament evidence, and it seemed to a number of people like it made sense. It's not until we get there that we get you might say a viable alternative, and that is what occasioned the calling of the Council of Nicaea, the teaching of Arius, who taught that Jesus is divine and he's human, but that there was a time when Jesus was not. The second person of the Trinity was not. So that puts Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, in this precarious position. Is he really God? Is he fully God or not? So the church did have a number of deliberations, Nicaea being the main important one there, but then other councils as well, to try to sort that out. And it was decided that Arius' position, while sounding biblical in many ways, was not fully biblical. It didn't satisfy the criteria laid out, you might say, by John's Gospel and by Paul's letter to the Colossians and the book of Hebrews and so forth, and this the honoring of Christ as fully God. So the Arian controversy, which started in the 4th century, early 4th century, and was decided against at the Council of Nicaea, and for many, many years the church still struggled with that. Arianism was a new thing, even though it claimed to represent the tradition of the church.
Now, when you were saying all that, I was thinking about how when you got to the point where you said there was a time the sun was not, that there are some listeners out there who are probably atheist and Muslim who could be saying, wait, didn't Tertullian himself say there was a time when the sun was not?
Yeah, I don't believe so. As I said earlier, Christians before the time of Nicaea, before Athanasius, probably did express themselves at times in inadequate ways and didn't tie up the loose ends, you might say. So there are some statements that Tertullian makes that have left him open to that kind of criticism or objection. But I think when you read all
Dr.
of what
Hero,
he says,
I think,
yes,
Dr. Hero?
Yes.
I think we've got Dr. Turing here on the line. Dr. Turing, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. This has been a trial finding a connection. Sorry to interrupt, guys.
Yeah, and sorry that it took so long. We'll let Dr. Hill finish his point right quick, and
Absolutely. Then we'll
go on from there.
Well, just very quickly, I think when you look at all of Tertullian's statements, it's very clear that he believes Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, is not a created being. He's co-essential with the Father. He is of the same essence. But he clearly states that, and he gets us very close to the Nicene statement. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, since we got Dr. Turing here, what I'm going to do then is, so you can get in the most time about interruption, I'm going to go ahead and take our third break and come back, and we'll have Dr. Turing here to discuss certain matters. And I'm Nick Peters with the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio shows on your Apple or Android-powered devices. Best of all, it's absolutely free. So get it now in the Google Play or iTunes App Store, or grab a link at cyiworldwide.com.
And we're back here, and we've got Dr. Turing and Dr. Bird. I mean, Dr. here online. Dr. Bird should be joining us later on here. But next week, if you're here, we're going to actually have Hugh Ross joining us. He's going to be talking about two of his books, Hidden Treasures and Book of Job, and Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And then we're going to be, in the second half, talking about Asperger's and apologetics for Autism Awareness Month, Hugh himself being an Aspie, just like yours truly here is. But now we've got Dr. here and Dr. Turing. Now, Dr. Turing, you wrote a lot on par and Ehrman's usage of par. What do you think about how Ehrman used par overall?
Well, first of all, is Charles Hill still on the line?
Yes.
Oh, well,
yes.
Just to say hi there. We haven't actually spoken before, but there we are. Thank you for your comments on my chapter. Paul,
pleasure.
Well, to be honest, Bart Ehrman doesn't have too much to say on Paul, which is part of my complaint in the chapter where I deal directly with this. He does a little bit of exegesis of Philippians chapter 2, and particularly what's called the Philippians hymn or Philippians poem, whatever you want to call it, verses 6-11. What I try to do in my chapter is only very briefly touch on that, really. I think his exegesis is a little shaky, but the more problematic issue is that's the only piece of exegetical work that he does in Paul's letters. And so I try to raise the reader's attention to Christological material in Paul that absolutely must be taken account of and which he didn't address.
Yeah, you've got a great line here. You say, fourth, and I want this point to sink in, Ehrman's questionable exegesis of Philippians 2, 6-11 is the only extended engagement with Paul's letter in his entire book. Ehrman has constructed a case about the nature of Paul's Christology by analyzing in depth only 6 verses and 1 passage. Just 1 passage. Your coffee or tea should be in the process of being spat out over this book in disbelief. Now, of course, that is a very important passage for Paul's Christological understanding, but there are so many more passages he could have gone through. Why do you think he didn't interact with Paul more?
Well, I don't think it's unique to Bart Ehrman to focus a little too exclusively on Philippians 2, 6 to 11. You know, how it is in New Testament studies is often scholars will specialize and atomize and in order to write detailed exegesis on a passage about a given subject, they simply can't focus on everything in Paul's letters. And so what's happened is scholars over the years have tended to focus on what have, you know, the classically important texts of Christology, 1 Corinthians 8, 6, and Philippians 2, 6 to 11 being the key. So he's not alone in doing this, but that's not to justify his move. I think there's Christology in Philippians chapter 1 and Philippians chapter 3 that's equally, if not more important than the Philippians hymn, as I've argued in my book, Paul's Divine Christology, but elsewhere as well. And as for why doesn't he engage with Paul more is a good question, because Paul's letters, it's the earliest set of Christian documents that we have. You know, these documents go back to the 50s AD, and maybe even earlier. And I have a friend who's just going to publish a book called Framing Paul, and he argues pretty cogently that First Thessalonians may even go back into early 40s. So we're dealing with very early texts here, and I think it's a lacuna. It's a mistake in his work not to engage more thoroughly with Paul's Christology. If he had done, I think there would have been considerable problems for his wider thesis, especially this move from exaltation Christology to incarnational Christology. I mean, that is simply refuted in Paul.
I think earlier in the book that Michael Bird had said that when he sees Ehrman say something about historical Jesus, he wants to tweet epic facepalm to him, because Ehrman always says that we don't know what the original text said. Now, what that has to do with you, Dr. Tilling, is I put this in the notes here on my copy of the book. On page 103, you talk about how Ehrman says that we can find in the text traditions, out of oral traditions, and I agree with that, of course, that go to before the time the New Testament was written. Of course, obvious ones are 1 Corinthians 15. And Ehrman then in his book tries to go back to what these oral traditions were. And I put this here, it says, we can't know the original text, according to Ehrman, but we can know what the oral tradition is behind the text. It just struck me as a bizarre situation for Ehrman there.
Yeah, I think as well, when he comes to engage, whether it's oral tradition or whether it's pre-Christian sources, which is something he tries to do, and again, he's not alone in doing this. Classically, Romans chapter 1, there's some material in chapter 1 that many consider to be pre-Pauline. In other words, it looks as though Paul is using tradition that's older than him. But the problem is he's very selective in the way he uses or he tries to work with pre-Pauline tradition, and that's what I highlight in my chapter.
Well, I'd like to point out now that it looks like we've got another caller coming in here, and I think Dr. Bird, are you here also now?
Yep, I'm right here, mate. Good to see you, Nick.
And good to hear from you. So all three of you are together now. Now, when we put Dr. Tearing on, we realized that's the first time he'd got to talk with Dr. Hero. So is this the first time for you also, any Dr. Bird?
For me talking to who?
Any one of these two.
No, I've had the pleasure of their acquaintance a great many times. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's good to
too
see
many times, Mike.
Too many times, particularly now that Australia is once again in the ascendancy of the cricket.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, move on.
Yeah, yeah. We might as well move on, because I have no idea what you're talking about there. I don't pay attention to sports any. When the Super Bowl comes on over here, I read a book during the game and put it down during the commercials. That's the kind of guy you're dealing with.
Okay, well, I'll give you a hint, Nick. Cricket is not an insect. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I know that much. I know Ravi Zacharias has talked about playing cricket when he grew up, and I think he pretty much said it's like playing T-bar, except you get, or playing baseball or some sort, except you get served tea. Which,
okay.
To me, sounds like a great sport if you get served tea. But anyway, now, you are you're free to jump in here, because I'm going to be trying to ask questions to each of you as much as I can here. I've already spent some time with Dr. Hero, so he said to give deference to you two. But he did say that, Dr. Bird, when you come on, you need to tell us about how this book came about. I mean, it wasn't that both publishers got together and said, hey, let's do this little juxtaposition. You publish one book here, I'll publish one book here, and let's see how they go. What is the real story here?
Well, let me clarify. There was definitely no conspiracy theory. Harper One and Zondervan did not get together and concoct an idea to corner both sides of the Christology market and to come up with one book against Jesus as divine and another book in favor of it. Basically, at the last Society of Biblical Literature, which was held in Baltimore, I was walking up and down the bookstalls, and I saw these huge, massive advertisements for Bart Ehrman's forthcoming book, How Jesus Became God. And I saw this, and immediately I realized that in the coming months, I'm going to be getting emails from people who have heard of or have read or who have been talking to people who have read Ehrman's book, and I'm going to have to get very busy telling these people that whatever Bart is saying probably ain't the way it is. So for the sake of clearing my email box, I knew it would be a good idea if I did some what I would call some preemptive pastoral apologetics. And I had, from Ehrman's other works, I had a pretty good idea where he was going to go with this. So I thought, well, you know, it'd be good to come up with a response, even if it's something like a short ebook or something. And I cruised around the exhibit halls, and I came across some of my good friends, including Chris Tilling, Craig Evans, and Simon Gathercole. And I said, what do you guys think about doing a short response to Ehrman? And lucky for me, Simon and Chris were both very open to that idea. I then went up to one of my editors, to my publisher, Zondervan, and I told them the idea I was thinking of. They told me I was crazy and I was stupid. And I said, but I've got Chris Tilling and Simon Gathercole already willing to do it. And then they realized that my craziness might in fact be a form of genius. And it was at that point that we then got to work on the book. We were graciously allowed to see a copy of Bart Ehrman's book in advance. So we were able to see the manuscript, and we read over that around the Christmas New Year period. And that was a cracking good read on Christmas Day, let me tell you that. And so yeah, we worked over the manuscript, and we all had all different areas we're going to respond to based on our expertise. Chris is obviously a bit of a guru swami ninja on Paul's Christology. Simon Gathercole has done some excellent work on the Christology in the Synoptic Gospels and worked in the non-canonical Gospels as well. I've done a bit of historical Jesus stuff. And so, yeah, we found our areas we're going to work on. Then we got to work, put the manuscript together, went through a lightning-fast editorial period, and as we would say, Bob's your uncle, here we are.
Now, I did try and contact Harper Winway. I did contact them and see if I could get a copy for the show so I could have a better discussion. Unfortunately, that didn't come about, so I've got your all's book here, and that's working good enough. Now, I've already heard this from Dr. here, but why do you all think that this book is so important?
Well, let me put this way. Bart Ehrman has a huge influence.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I frequently get emails from people who have come across someone who's read one of his books and is convinced that the whole Christian thing is just a big mistake.
Right.
And in fact, I would say I've received a number of emails from Christians in the Middle East who have been discussing, debating with Muslims Christianity, and these Muslims in the Middle East are pointing to the works of Bart Ehrman as reasons why Christians in the Middle East should give up their faith and become Muslim. So for me, that's one of the reasons why I think a book like this is important, because for Jehovah's Witnesses, Unitarians, Muslims, they're going to think all their Christmases have come at once. Now, I know there's an irony in that, because Ehrman is putting together a very popular and interesting proposal that Jesus is not in fact God, he's just a human being. And I think if people are going to get the history right, know what the New Testament says, know about the archaeology as well, I think it's crucial that they know that Bart is not holding all the aces, that there is an alternative way of understanding the origins of devotion to Jesus as a divine Lord. So for those reasons alone, I think the book is worth reading by a lot of people.
Dr. Turing, do you have anything to add to that?
No, not really. I think Mike has nailed it there. I think as well, when I'm reading a book like Bart's, it's also a matter of academic rigor, of being academically vigorous. And I think we need to call him out on a few issues relating to that. Nothing else, though, beyond that to add to Mike's comments.
Now, I'd just asked Dr. Turing about this, and it relates to something Dr. Bird, that you and him both talked about, and so maybe we can have some good back and forth on this one here. But earlier in the book, Dr. Bird, you said, "I have to confess that whenever I read Bart Ehrman saying anything about the historical Jesus, I often feel like tweeting, at Bart Ehrman, epic facepalm." And the reason for that is that he keeps saying we can't know what the text said, but it's unreliable, it's untrustworthy, but I'm going to use that text anyway and tell you about Jesus. Now, when we get to page 103, Ehrman talks about how he's going to try and figure out what Christians believed in 30 to 50 A.D., or as he has it, C.E., and that's by going to the oral traditions that are behind the text. Now, of course, I'm not disputing those traditions exist. Of course they do. But I read this and I just put it in my notes here immediately. We can't know the original text, but we can know the oral tradition. And I just found that fascinating.
Yeah, I find it fascinating in the sense that there's a glorious incoherence in Ehrman's argument. You know, he says in his other books, like Misquoting Jesus, where he emphasizes at length the instability in the textual tradition of our New Testament manuscripts. And let me say, Ehrman is a first-class textual critic. He has done some very good work, and he has my highest respect. I'm not questioning his work as a text critic. I think in his popular-level books, he has overemphasized some of the evidence for the fluidity and instability of our textual manuscripts, and other people have answered him on those grounds, ranging from Dan Wallace and others. But this is the problem I have with Ehrman. You know, he will take his happy agnostic bus on a tour around America, saying things like, "We can't talk about the Word of God because we don't even know what the actual words were." And then in the next book, he will then use the New Testament as the basis for reconstructing the historical Jesus, the Apostle Paul, Mary Magdalene, and Peter. And in my mind, you just can't do that. You can't write one book and say the emperor has no clothes, and then in the next book say, "I love what the emperor was wearing at the Vanity Fair Oscars party." So part of me would like to know which of Bart's own books does he believe? Because the stuff he says in his book, Misquoting Jesus, would rule out any chance of him saying anything about historical figures or the oral tradition behind the New Testament. You know, both of these things simply cannot be true. Now, sometimes when Bart is in more scholarly forums, he'll be more guarded, less, populist, and less extravagant about his claims, and he'll be a little bit more upbeat about our ability to reconstruct the original, or at least an initial text of the New Testament. So there's a bit of a duality going on here. Sometimes Barth makes these extravagant and outrageous claims about the corruption of the New Testament, but in other forums he's a little bit more upbeat about it. And I think that's a little bit of duplicity, which, you know, I'm not particularly fond of. But if you take his main claims that, you know, the Bible is corrupt or the New Testament is corrupted, it's fluid, unstable, and yet he's still able not only to use it but go behind it, I think methodologically that leaves some great big questions to be answered and some huge inconsistencies in what he's saying about the early church and his ability to study them.
Now, since you did mention Dan Waris and textual criticisms, I mean, we obviously can't spend the whole show talking about that. I will tell people, if you want to find out more about that, Dan Waris will be on the Deeper Waters podcast here on April 19th, so June and then, I'm sure we'll be talking about Ehrman Private Prayer. Now, since you talk about his methodology, Dr. Tierling, one thing I've noticed about Ehrman's methodology is that he seems to be extremely literalist and rather fundamentalist in his handling of Scripture. And you can tell it made an impact on him because you can hardly read a book by him where he doesn't mention his Mark II deconversion story where he pretty much had his Damascus Road experience. Mm. Now, when you've seen how he's interpreting the text here, I mean, the only extended work he does in part is Philippians 2, but of course he touches other texts. Do you notice the same kind of thing, that he has a rather literalistic reading of the New Testament?
I can't say I've seen the same in Paul, to be honest. I would call his reading unsophisticated rather than literalistic when it comes to Paul. He's not too self-critical, it seems to me, at least in this book, when it comes to the interpretive categories that he is using to, with such decisive effect, to interpret whole swathes of New Testament material. He's not really reflecting very deeply on those categories, and of course that's what I spend a chapter having a go at.
Dr. Bird, what do you think about that? In the material that you handled as well, do you think that Ehrman usually does take a more literalistic approach that would rather be foreign to the text?
In some cases, I think he does. I wouldn't say it's an overarching characteristic of him. You know, Ehrman does have a fundamentalist Christian background, you know, in places like, you know, Moody Bible Institute and other places. And that's probably left a little bit of an imprint on the way he handles the text. But with Chris, I'd say sometimes that the problem is maybe not a strict or wooden literalism. Sometimes it's more of an unsophistication. Or sometimes it looks like he's trying to push certain texts into a certain interpretation that looks like it might fit, but on closer examination doesn't really add up if you look at it in depth.
Well, I've got another question to ask, but we're going to take a quick break right now. I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast. We've got Dr. Charles here, Dr. Chris Tierling, and Dr. Michael Bird, quite a group here, all together talking about their book, How God Became Jesus. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back, and I do want to remind all of you out there listening that, yes, everything we do here is listener support at Grock Talk Radio, and specifically everything I do at Deeper Waters is supported by you. Please consider going to deeperwaters.wordpress.com, my own blog there, and making a donation to support the work that you see going on here, rather in this case, here going on here. I'm doing the best I can to get you the best in scholarship. We got three brilliant minds right here doing great work for the kingdom and I want to keep it up with bringing it to you. And if you click there, you'll find out how you can make a donation to what I'm doing. And it's done through Ratio Christi. And that will be, by the way, tax deductible. So what have you got to lose? You make a great investment in the kingdom, and you get a nice little tax deduction for it. Now, for all three of you, one claim that has to be understood is what it's actually meant by saying that Jesus is divine. Erman means something by it, and when we say how God became Jesus, we mean something. I mean, when we say Jesus is God, I recognize that's theological shorthand, but we still mean something. So what are we talking about when we talk about the divinity of Jesus, and what do you think Erman's talking about when he does the same?
I was going to say, if Chuck's there, it'd be good to get an exposition from him about what he thinks the mature or final definition of Jesus' divinity is by the standards of Christian orthodoxy.
Well, certainly by the time we get to the definitions of Nicaea and beyond, Christians are talking about deity as uncreated, and in practical terms, we worship God. We don't worship things that are not God. We could talk about more technical terminology, but uncreated and the whole terminology as used for the Son, that is begotten but not created. Theologians spend a lot of time discussing that distinction, and that's a distinction that has a long prehistory before Nicaea. Tertullian used it, Justin Martyr used it, and going back all the way to the Gospel of John. So that is a very important distinction, that God is uncreated, self-existent, and unlimited. We can go on a number of theological terms, but I think just to stay with something as very basic as that, maybe those two things, because I think they both relate to some of the earlier discussion that Bart does, and then that Mike does as well in the first chapters of our book.
Okay, Dr. Burr, Dr. Tuen, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think Chris puts it very well in terms of summarizing what we would call Nicene Christology, and that is the view that Jesus is fully God, he's begotten, not made, he's not a created being. I think that's a good summary of it. And it's not just something that appears in 325, it does have antecedents in guys like Tertullian, Irenaeus, Justin, and others. There's a bit of diversity along the way as they get there, for sure. But the big question is, and this is where I think Ehrman is right to push us on, is how far does that Nicene or Nicene-esque Christology go back into the New Testament? Now, that is a genuine question, because I think it would be wrong to say that, 10 seconds after Pentecost, that God basically downloaded the Nicene Creed into the mind of all the apostles and all the Christians. It did take some working out, some figuring out, right, as Christians had to think through their faith, my goodness, what has just happened? We've just seen a man we thought was a prophet, the Messiah, crucified, rise from the dead. He seems to speak not simply from God, but for God from the inside, and now he's exalted to God's right hand. And I think it did take them a while to come up with the right grammar, the right categories, find out which scriptures best explicate his person. And so what we need to think, though, is whether the move from the New Testament to Nicaea, there is some degree of development going on. The question is whether it is a logical development or whether it is more akin to a type of evolution. Now, I'd be interested to hear from Chris Tilling, as where does he think Paul stands in relation to a Nicene Christology? Is Paul providing the ingredients for what would later become a Nicene Christology, or is it more the case that the Nicene Christology, the Nicene view of Jesus, is a fundamental misinterpretation of Paul and, say, John? I'd be here to hear from Chris on that one.
Yeah, but that's a key question, isn't it, Mike? And where I would position Paul on this, and I'm trying and pains in the chapter to try to make a very brief case for this, is that what we have in Paul is something that is very logically translated into slightly different terms, where words relating to ontology directly are developed. But what we have in Paul is something, a very Jewish way of expressing what we would understand as Nicene orthodoxy, and that's absolutely crucial, you see, because I'm unpersuaded that Bart Ehrman has done the work of a historian in his work here. He hasn't really defined his terms, and in particular, the question at the beginning was, what does it mean to speak of Christ as divine? And what Bart Ehrman has done in the book is use this as a very nebulous concept into which you can sling pretty much anything from God occasionally right through to angels and demons, because he's well aware that the New Testament says some very exalted things about Jesus, you know, some incredible things about Jesus Christ. So how do we account for that, he's asking himself? Well, Jesus is divine, but not God Almighty. That's his key claim, that Christ is divine but not God Almighty. Of course, God Almighty is divine as well, but this is precisely the kind of terminology he deploys in order to create a distinction between God the Father and the Son, or the Lord Jesus Christ, at what would in Nicene terms would be an ontological level. I think all of this runs roughshod over the New Testament text. If we're going to do the work of a historian, then we need to really think back in to their mindset and really wrestle with some complicated issues relating to ontology, relating to epistemology. That is, how do we know things? And when we put all of the pieces together, as I argue in my chapter, what we have is a very Jewish way of including Jesus on the divine side of the line monotheism must draw between God and creatures. In other words, what we have is a Jewish way of speaking of Christ as homoousios with the Father.
Yeah, I think it's really important, Dr. Tim, that you want to emphasize the Jewish way and how Paul would see it, because I was going to go straight to you as well with this, since Paul is really our earliest, as far as we know, as far understanding of the way Jesus was viewed. And one passage in the Old Testament that Paul did interact with, and Ehrman never does in his book, is the Shema, for our listeners, the Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Now, how important would that be to understanding divinity in the Jewish sense, and how does Paul use that text?
Yeah, great question. You know, the Shema was the closest thing that Second Temple Judaism had to a creed. There's a good chance that the Jews were praying the Shema twice daily. You know, this was very much in the horizon of their imagination, and it was a text which spoke of, well, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength. And then it went on. There was quite a few other texts added to it. And it's very interesting how Paul then deploys the Shema in his letters. And I did find it quite amazing that Bart Ehrman didn't mention the Shema, even though he spends quite a lot of time speaking about Jewish monotheism. I say a little bit cheekily in the chapter, but it's a little bit like speaking of the Second World War with forgetting to mention Winston Churchill. I think it was poor scholarship. But what does Paul do with the Shema? This is a fascinating issue. The Shema, the identity of the transcendent uniqueness of God, involved a loving commitment to the one God of Israel. And that's exactly how the Shema runs in Deuteronomy chapter 6. It's the confession of the oneness of God is coupled with a confession relating to our love. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 8 through to 10 is speak about the relationship between Christians and the risen Lord using Shema language. And Paul bends this to speak of Christ. So what do we do, what do we have here? We have a Jew wrestling with the concepts available to him in order to speak about Christ as sharing the transcendent uniqueness of God. And this is just simply Paul's language for doing this. We've all got this, whether it be Tertullian, whether it be Athanasius, whether it be Paul. They were all wrestling with the impact of Jesus with the language and categories that they had, and they were all using that language to come to pretty much the same place.
Okay. Now, when we do talk about how God was viewed as divine here, we have to also realize that there was a kind of view that God was separate entirely from everything else, the creator-creation distinction that was made, which is stressed a lot in Bauckham, who you all mentioned. Ehrman does not interact with at all in the book, which is something very concerning. Now, Dr. Bird, you did a lot on this. How was it that God was seen as divine in the sense that nothing else was seen as divine?
Well, this is about the categories that you're using in terms of what is unique to God and what separates him from creation. Basically, and that is the main point, that God is the creator, not the created, and we only worship the creator, not created things. And this explains things like prohibition of the worship of angels, because angels themselves are created and subservient beings, and that's why you don't worship them. Now, where there was worship of angels, and you know, there are types of literature where you can find a type of veneration from angels, even there, it was not the same type of veneration that was given to Yahweh, given to Israel's Lord. There could be prayers made to angels in some literature, and things like magical amulets and that sort of thing, prayers for protection, but you never find the same devotion given to angels as is ordinary given to Yahweh, given to Israel's God. And that is fundamentally because there is a distinction between God and the created world. Based on what Chris has been saying, there I think is the basic definition of monotheism, that there is one God who made the world and all that is in it, and you worship him rather than anything else.
So, Dr. Tiering, I'm assuming that you'd agree with Dr. Bird and probably Richard Bauckham at the same time, who'd say that by putting Christ in the Shema, as it were, in 1 Corinthians 8, Paul is essentially Christianizing the Shema and including Jesus in that divine identity.
Yeah, Richard Bauckham is the most brilliant scholar I know in working in this area. It was a great pity that Bart Ehrman didn't show any engagement with him. I like a lot what Richard Bauckham does. I prefer to back away from the language of identity myself, but not to make a substantially different point. And I would only say in 1 Corinthians 8:6, which is the verse Richard Bauckham and others spend much time on, where Paul seems to Christianize the Shema, 1 Corinthians 8:6 is a part of a much longer argument. 1 Corinthians 8 through to 10, which speaks of Paul's response to the eating of food offered to idols. And so it's the whole section which speaks of divine Christology in the fullest sense, not just 8:6.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Hill, in response to all that, would you say that the church throughout its early history did keep up that distinction going on, that it recognized that God was uniquely divine, yet somehow included Jesus and the Holy Spirit in this as well, or would they just worship many other lesser divinities?
Excuse me. No, I don't think there is good evidence of that. It is, as Chris and Mike are saying, it's certainly the case that throughout the New Testament and on beyond into the early church, all the way through, we see devotion to Jesus as devotion to Yahweh. And this comes out in so many ways. I think Chris did an excellent job in one of his chapters in explicating that, in how we see in Paul, for instance, it's not just the words he might use about Jesus and in the same way he might use these words about Yahweh, God Almighty, God the Father, but it's in the devotion to it's the prayers, it's worship of, it's the entire fabric surrounding his language and his life, his patterns of thinking, that we see the same sort of reference, the same sort of attitude and devotion towards Jesus as we do to God the Father. And this is certainly a very consistent all the way through into the early church. I'm sure if Simon were here, we'd be talking a little bit more even about the Gospels and about Jesus' own usage. And I think of simply where he poses the question of who is the Christ? Whose son is he? And where he says, well, if he's David's son, how is it that that David calls him Lord? Saying that the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. This was a very important text that Jesus himself alluded to. Very important that was picked up on in the early church as well. And one thing that I went into a little bit in one of my chapters was how it is this understanding of the Old Testament itself and the various it's finding that the persons of God, the persons of the Godhead in the Old Testament that introduces even into the language, the evolving technical language of the church, the concept of person with regard to the distinctions in the Trinity. Christian exegetes would ask, well, who are the persons speaking in the Psalm 110, the Lord says to my Lord, who is speaking when we have each of these statements being made? And they would talk about the person of the Father and the person of the Son or the person of the Holy Spirit. This did give the basis for the technical language, the Trinitarian language of three persons within the Godhead, but being of the same essence. So it really is a very natural and organic development that we see going all the way back to Jesus and his provocative questions that he put in his lifetime through Paul and the rest of the New Testament writers and through Justin and Irenaeus and on and on up until the 4th century definitions.
Well, with that, we're going to need to take a quick break. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guests are Dr. Charles Hero, Dr. Michael Bird, and Dr. Chris Turing. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show. Free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
Hey,
And we're back to the Deeper Waters podcast. We're in our final segment here. Now, Dr. Hira just talked about Psalm 110:1, which I think is, in fact, the most quoted verse of the Old Testament that's found in the New Testament, and how that shaped Jesus' understanding of himself. And so let's get Dr. Bird on this question. How do you think Jesus saw himself and his relation to God? And it wasn't the case, you think, for instance, that he was walking around and just back and saying, "Hey, I'm God," over and over. How did he see himself?
I think, first of all, you're right, Nick. You know, Jesus did not cruise around Galilee and Judea saying, "Hi, I'm God, second person of the Trinity. I'm going to die on the cross soon for your sins. But before that, let me tell you some good stories you can use in Sunday school in the future." And anyway, one credit to Ehrman, Ehrman at least enables us to explore that kind of naive way of thinking about what Jesus was saying about himself. So whatever Ehrman's failings, if you read him, you definitely won't come across with that idea that Jesus is walking around so heavenly minded, you know, reminiscing of the times where he was playing the harp with the angels up in heaven, that type of thing. What Jesus claims is that he is sent from God, and that he has come to put into effect the kingdom of God that God has promised the Israelites, a kingdom that is also going to come to Judea, but it's going to expand and include the entire world. And his central claim is that he is the king of that kingdom. And as we read more about what he says as well, we see some claims that go along with that. Jesus seems to speak and act with a divine authority, an unmediated authority. He doesn't simply say, "Thus, you know," or "the word of the Lord came to me." He speaks as one who has an interior point of view in the mind of God. He speaks from God on the inside. So he makes some very unique claims. He also seems to identify himself with God's own activity in the world. And there's a number of sayings we could go into on this one. And very astonishing as well, he claims that he is going to be enthroned with God. Not on a throne next to God, not his own miniature throne, but he says he's going to share the very throne of God. And that is a great claim to a divine regency, which means he is going to rule and be worshipped as one who is God. So I think there are, in to various degrees, both explicit and implicit, divine claims made by Jesus in the Gospels.
Dr. Tiering, do you think that would be backed further, that Paul would have shared that same understanding of Jesus' claims? I mean, look at passages like Romans 1:3-4 and Philippians 2:5-11, or passages about Jesus even judging the world and such?
I'll be honest with you, I faced out a bit there. I've already had a couple of glasses of wine. I'm at a wedding reception. So could you just say the question again?
How Jesus saw himself as occupying God's throne alongside him, not just sitting on a throne, but uniquely as the agent of God through whom God would rule his kingdom. And so I was tying in that throne aspect to Romans 1 and Philippians 2.
Paul does have quite a bit to say about the enthronement of Jesus, and Timo Escola has written probably the best monograph on this issue when it comes to Paul. It's clearly going on there in Paul. Paul is doing some work with Christ sitting at the right hand of the Father and so on, and Christ is clearly an exalted agent in Paul. But that's not to say the same thing that Bart Ehrman says with that. He would agree with what I've just said. But we do need to take what the dominant language and the dominant pattern of Christologically relevant data in Paul much more seriously than Bart Ehrman does. And then things start to come into sharp focus. And what we have is an exalted agent who is uniquely exalted in the sense that he shares God's transcendent uniqueness.
You know, my humorous side is thinking me that we should all be impressed that you're able to wax so eloquently on Christology and Paul and Queen Bartram and after having a couple glasses of wine. This is what biblical scholars do, after all.
Well, think of me. I just woke up 40 minutes ago. It's 7 o'clock. I'm sitting here with my pajamas and a cup of tea, wondering why he's drinking wine at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I got up at 5:30 in the morning one time to do a debate on Unbelievable, so I feel your pain there.
It sounds like a good thing we're not all on Skype.
Yes.
A lot of us are. Dr. Bird, one aspect of this that you brought out that I thought was pretty interesting is we can easily think of a passage such as Jesus answering Caiaphas in Matthew 26 about the phone, but one that you brought out was the account of the rich young ruler and how Bartimaeus does say this is a passage where Jesus seems to treat the Son of Man as someone else. But if that's the case, if the apostles are going to be sitting on 12 thrones, what's Jesus going to be doing?
Yeah, I mean, one of the arguments that Anwin puts forth is that Jesus thought of the Son of Man, the coming Son of Man, as a figure other than himself. Now, this was a view that had some traction a number of decades ago. But to be perfectly honest, I think it kind of died around the same time that disco did. One second, I've got children waking up wanting to get ready for school, for church. Anwin puts forward that, and then sometimes you can see where he gets it from. You can see in certain sayings, you can see it's possible to read that way. But when you view the Son of Man sayings globally, it becomes virtually impossible for two reasons. Number one, in a lot of places, the Son of Man is clearly a form of self-reference to Jesus. And, I mean, we could go into the Aramaic background of the Son of Man sayings and what Son of Man or Bar Inasha means in Aramaic. We could go into that, and that would be a further indication of the self-referential nature of a lot of sayings. In fact, when I was reading Bart Ehrman's book, I was reading it wondering what Maurice Casey would say to this. Maurice Casey is a non-believing biblical scholar, and he would share a view that Jesus's divine nature evolved, but he has a very different idea about the Son of Man sayings and what they mean, and he would be completely against Ehrman. So on the one hand, the Son of Man sayings are clearly self-referential, but in other cases, if you adopt Ehrman's view, you get some really odd things going on. For example, when Jesus says to the 12 disciples something along the lines of, you know, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, and then the Son of Man will be on his throne as well. So if the Son of Man gets a throne, if the 12 disciples get a throne, well, where is Jesus? But particularly if he is, as Ehrman says, the Messiah of God's kingdom, well, what does he get? Does he get to sit outside on the bench or something? So you've just really got some real odd things going on. And I think Ehrman's take on the Son of Man sayings and a Son of Man Christology is probably one of the weaker elements of his book.
Mm. Well, we've only got about 11 and a half minutes left in the show here, and normally I do things a bit later, but since we've got three guests here, I'm going to have to divide the time out between all of you here. Now, I'd like everyone to know, the book is available on Amazon right here. It's How God Became Jesus, The Real Origins of Belief in Jesus' Divine Nature, A Response to Bart Ehrman. The other authors are Craig Evans and Simon Gavrico, but we've got Dr. Charles here, Dr. Michael Bird, and Dr. Chris Tilling here already, and somehow, Dr. Tilling, you got left out here on the mention on Amazon. You're going to have to do something about that. And
There may have been a reason for that.
I'm sure there was. We just don't know it.
Of course, it's a global conspiracy against me. I know it.
It's because of pseudo scholarship, right?
That's exactly right.
Yes, there, it's an inside joke based on a new review that's popped up here. But it's for sale on Kindle $9.78 and on paperback for $12.56. Now, I'd like to just wrap things up by having each of you just give some final messages and such. So, Dr. Bird, let's start with you here. First off, if someone's really keen on what they've heard from you so far and such, and they want to know more, how can someone get in touch if you find out more?
Well, you can follow me at Twitter on at MikeBird12. I also have a blog, which I do with my friend Joel Willits, called Evangelion. Or if you, you know, troll around through Amazon, you could probably find a few other books by me as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to leave the audience here with what would be like your final main message to them concerning this book or anything else, what would it be?
Well, my message would be is that, you know, Bart M is a very good communicator, and he raises some very, very good questions which we have to seriously engage. I'm not going to dismiss him as a crank, because he's not. He's a very learned chap. He's a very capable scholar and a very good communicator. So you just can't ignore him and hope that he'll go away.
Right.
So we need to take him seriously, and he does make some good points here and there. Mm-hmm. But he's not holding all the aces. And there is a better way of doing history, less open to some of these inconsistencies in methodology, and there is a more coherent account of the story of how the early church came to see that in Jesus they had met God face to face. And I don't know if you remember that song by Joan Osborne, What If God Was One of Us? It's somewhat of a melancholic and mocking song.
Yeah, we used to watch Joan of Arcadia over here, and that was famous.
Ah, yeah, yeah. So the good news is that God was one of us, and God is for us. And that we see in the cross, in Jesus Christ, God is reconciling the world to himself. That's the message I would want people to take away.
And if we could go to Romans 8 with that, we could say, if God can be for us, who can be against us?
Amen.
Now, Dr. Turing, do you have a presence on the web, a place that if people want to find out more, they can go and get some more information about you?
Yeah, sure. I've got a Twitter account, but, you know, I tend to post pictures of cats on there most of the time. I've got a blog, Christendom,
Without the
tea. The place where I've developed some of my own ideas about Paul's Christology is a book called Paul's Divine Christology. Now, for any of your listeners who are strapped and loaded with cash, feel free to go ahead and buy a copy. But my apologies that when you look at the price tag, you probably won't be too impressed. I think as well, you know, with the whole issue of Christology is as Mark so brilliantly put there, you know, Bart Ehrman is someone we can actually learn from, and somebody Christians should indeed read and wrestle with. But more fundamentally, I think what these two books ask us to do is to continue to wrestle with the question of who Jesus is. And even putting it like that, who is Jesus rather than who was Jesus, points out the fact that we're dealing with something quite unique here. And I hope that that's an encouragement that people can take away with them. And I can certainly vouch in my own life to wrestle with the question of Jesus is to be confronted with God's unconditional love. And that is good news indeed. And that's why I think it's worthwhile probing these questions as best as we can.
I'm not sure what you mean about the price of your book. I just looked and it's still at $112 and 10.
Yeah, by the way, I'd be very glad.
Yeah, and with what you were saying about who Jesus is, I'm thinking about my ministry partner just released something on the blood moons thing, and whenever I'm involved in debates with eschatology, I always keep saying the same thing over and over. It seems like more Christians are concerned with trying to figure out who the Antichrist is than trying to figure out who Christ is, and if only we could get that reversed.
Yeah, well, I met a guy in an elevator in Boston who was convinced that the Antichrist was Hillary Clinton. So I think that's pretty much done and dusted, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, Mike. I think we're all agreed on that one, yeah.
Now, Dr. Hira, go ahead.
Go ahead.
And Dr. Hill, you haven't yet, since last week, have you caught up to the modern age and given yourself a web presence, have you?
Yeah, it's at michaelbird.com. No, I don't, actually. I try to be as inaccessible as possible, but I'm there for anyone who wants to drive to the deepest, darkest sections of Florida and knock on my door, but beware of the dogs.
I can't help but think the deepest, darkest sections of Florida would be pretty bright compared to the rest of the world.
Well, that's right. We're having an overcast day today, but yeah, it's pretty nice.
So
I guess I'm on the RTS Reformed Theological Seminary website.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's the one in Orlando for our interest,
because
there's quite a number of RTSs out there. What's the final message you would like to leave with my audience today?
Well, I would concur with my cohorts here in terms of Bart Ehrman and his contributions. They said earlier on, I think when all the dust settles, with everything, all the problems that he has raised and all the questions that he's thrown, I think in the end it will actually be seen to have helped the church, because
mm-hmm.
it has brought out of the woodwork a number of people to respond to some of the things that he said that really probably have not been dealt with, at least in an accessible way, very often. So I do look for this to happen with this Christology book as well. No doubt many will be disturbed, but I'm very happy to say that our book is there to help minister to them. One thing to keep in mind about this particular book is that despite the way Dr. Ehrman presents his material, really what we have a lot of is presuppositions rather than conclusions. That is, simply in terms of his overall Christological framework, his historiographical framework of moving from low to high. So we've talked about that before, but I think to keep that in mind, ask yourself, is this the result of dispassionate research, or is it something that's a presupposition? And finally, just what Chris said, the ultimate question that we all have to grapple with is who is Jesus? And, it's a question we know that our Lord put himself when he was put by himself to others when he was here. That is, who do people say that I am? And that's the question that we perennially need to ask and be thankful that we have the sure answers in the New Testament.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone for coming on. We had some difficulties sometime in there, and any technical difficulties I take full responsibility for on my end here, but I'm glad we got all of you together. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I'd like to thank Zondervan and Emily Varner for helping put this together as well. And hey, people, please go out and buy the book, and I fully agree with Dr. Hill. This is a great opportunity for us if we take advantage of it. Unfortunately, the church seems to drop the ball at times like this. Let's make sure we don't do that this time. Regards to everything that's going on here, we let Dr. Tiering get back to enjoying wine at his wedding, and Dr. Berg get back to getting his kids ready for church since it's Sunday morning over there, and Dr. Berg will be doing that, and we'll get Dr. Hill going back to suffering for Jesus in Florida over there. Next Saturday, we're going to have Hugh Ross again on the show talking about two of his books, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, and Why the Universe is the Way It Is, and then especially talking about Asperger's for Autism Awareness Month. It's going to be a great show. You won't want to miss it. I'd like to thank all my guests for coming on here. Thank you for taking the time to be on the Deeper Waters podcast.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Nick. Have a good day, mate.
We'll see you all next week. For now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off.